It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The race is on, and it really is on, as despite the cancellation of the Australian Grand Prix, Max Verstappen took on rivals from Real World Motorsport and the cream of sim racing in the Race All-Star eSport Battle. It was described as the greatest sim racing field ever seen, and across the three qualifying races and grand final, it certainly lived up to that with some gripping racing. I'm Ed Straw, and discussing this seminal esports event with me is Scott Mitchell, and we'll also have Mark Hughes joining us later on to talk Real World F1. Well, Scott, we've just finished watching the event. Excellent commentary from Jack Nicholson and Julian Palmer, just like a Grand Prix through their BBC radio commentary. And yeah, it was really gripping, even though we've watched it between midnight and 2 a.m. here in Melbourne, where we still are. It's yeah, it's been absolutely thrilling, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm feeling it now because we're in the early hours of the morning. But I didn't come all the way to Australia not to see a race. So I'm glad that the race was able to pull this off in association with R Factor 2 and got just such an amazing cast of drivers. There's no way I wasn't going to stay up and watch it. And I wasn't really sure sort of what to expect exactly from the crop of sim racing talent. I know that the very best of online racers, they are esports athletes, for want of a better way of putting it. I know that they operate at a really high level, but I just didn't know really what to expect from them in this format. I didn't know how the sort of the, because there are so many different factions of sim racing, just the prospect of it all coming together was fascinating. And I do have a lot of time for sim racing, and I do respect the level that it can be conducted at. But when it's something like this, you don't know, you can have all those names and all that attention and it not come off. And obviously we have an affiliation with this, so there was a little bit of nerves to see exactly how it was executed. But I've got to say, I'm really, really impressed. I thought it was so entertaining, and the fact that the pro drivers, as we're going to get on to, I'm sure, in a minute in more detail, didn't even crack the top six in the grand final shows just how high a level this was conducted at.
Yeah, it's a great event, obviously thrown together in double quick time since the cancellation of the Australian Grand Prix. The race, of course, effectively the sort of title partner of the race, so very fortunate to be involved. Yeah, the top six were all sim racers. So Zdeněk Šimunčič won from Kevin Siggy and Rudy van Buren. I'm sure you'll have heard probably at least one of those names.
Rudy.
Yep, he's obviously getting a foothold in real world racing as well. The top real racer, for want of a better world, although they're all real world racers, was IndyCar driver Felix Rosenqvist in seventh place, with Colton Herta, two-time IndyCar race winner, finished 10th in the grand final. Max Verstappen, obviously, is the big talking point for us. Obviously, you probably say the second biggest name in Formula One at the moment, behind Lewis Hamilton, so great to have him involved. He won his qualifying race from pole position. Slightly disappointing qualifying going into the final, and that left him in the midfield, and we didn't quite see exactly what happened to him in terms of what caused it, but there was a general coming together, and he ended up spinning at the first corner.
Yeah, Max was on imperious form in his qualifying heat, winning from pole position and winning at a canter after Rosenqvist had got the jump on him at the start, but he ran deep into turn one and spun. But in qualifying, for the main race, Max's lap was a lot better than it was in the first race. But the caliber of driver he was up against was the grand final, so it was the cream of the crop, and Max didn't quite have enough. And even so, not quite having enough in this context still put him in the mix to have a good race. But unfortunately, He was very quickly down to 21st. He ended up facing the wrong way after getting wiped out at the first corner in a bit of a turn one carnage. And then it was just topsy turvy. So he went from sort of inside the top 10 to outside the top 20, back up to 15th, back down to 19th, and then had a nice little charge up to 11th right at the very end. So I think Max probably enjoyed himself. I wondered if he'd rage quit at one. If not the first time he dropped to the back, maybe the second time when he suffered a second setback. But fair play to him, he cracked on, showed a bit of what he's about with his win in the first race, and then obviously the overtakes in the grand final. But I like to think that the fact that he wasn't able to just come back through and smash everybody, even though he is, as you say, second biggest name in F1 and his team boss in F1, Christian Horner, has been saying for about 18 months that he's the best driver in Formula 1, even better than Lewis Hamilton. That just goes to show just how good the drivers are and how specific and quality of discipline sim racing is.
It was interesting to watch how the races evolved. The first race, the first qualifying race, it was full of real world racers. Verstappen's in that. Rosenqvist, Nirjani, Maxi Gunter, the BMW Formula E driver, Danny Yunkadea, Antonio Felix da Costa, some very familiar names, and Esteban Pagano, the Indy 500 winner, Colton Herta, some Montoyas. So all quite familiar names, and that was quite a leery all over the place race. But then as we proceeded through the second and third race, there's with more what you might call professional sim racers, they were kind of more orthodox races, and actually, although you weren't always seeing that much overtaking, particularly at the front, you could see they were very kind of tense race with drivers really at the kind of top of their games. That was when it kind of looked almost the most authentic. Some of the dicing was really great, but didn't sort of to my eye, as someone who's familiar with real world racing, some of the cars moved, etc., wasn't quite right. But when you get that kind of chasing, just looking for any little mistake and chance to get close, and can you kind of have a look at a pass, that was when it was really authentic. That was the bit that really got me. Even though there wasn't much passing going on, it was just that really kind of high level drivers really at the top of their game doing it.
Well, that fight between Siggy and Van Buren for second place in the final was superb. It ran the duration of the event, and Simicic broke away towards the end of the race, but that battle for second just didn't relent. And Van Buren, you could see the car, you see the body language of the car, you see how much he was hassling it. I know you say like you don't have quite the nuances of the sort of physics, do you, in this sort of thing, but it is still really good, and you can see the car twitching underneath him. And picking up on your point about the way the race has evolved and just the quality of it, I like to think that the really cool thing about an event like this is I feel like you saw what something like this, something that esports has to offer, which is it's not to say it's an out and out replacement for something like the season opener for Formula One in 2020, but it's a damn good supplement to it, and it shows it can step in and fill the void if required. Because in race one, you had the brilliant performance of Verstappen out front, and then I think it was Rosenqvist and Rosenqvist had a bit of a scruffy race, but like Herta and Gunter had really solid drives, and Da Costa was a little bit leery, Rosenqvist was a little bit leery, and there was a few bits and bobs and clashes, and it was star names, and it was a bit hectic. So it was a bit like watching a sort of glorified British touring car race in a way, because it was just a little bit mental with some really good drivers in the mix. And then the second one was okay, these are guys that you might see in like the F1 esports series and stuff like that, and it's slightly more refined, but it's still a bit messy. And then race three in your final, that was like, yeah, these are proper, if you like, as you were describing it, that sort of traditional hardcore racing where okay, it's not quite as leery, it's not quite as overtakes happening left, right and center, but it comes down to those really fine margins. That's proper competition. And I'm not trying to force this, that's what puts the sport in esports, because there is some proper craft there. It takes focus, it takes concentration, it takes speed and consistency, and I really don't think you can talk it down.
Yeah, I mean it's the only bit of racing we've got at the moment. So that the positive thing is that people have been drawn into watching this. So having these real world names will have, I imagine, attracted plenty of eyeballs from people not familiar with esport racing. And obviously, although I've watched a few bits and pieces, some of the F1 stuff, I would say I'm largely fairly ignorant of the world of e-sport racing, but actually also quite interested in it. It's one of those things that it's actually quite difficult from the outside because there's all these different categories and championships. You know, if you look at the roster of some of the Formula One teams with their e-sport drivers, they're huge in terms of the list of drivers they've got, but they've got specialists in various different sims. Obviously, this was R Factor that they raced on this, but there's many other games that are used as well. So this actually was also quite a nice little kind of taster, shall we say, and there'll be names from all sorts of different forms of e-sport racing in there, as well as real world. So it was quite a nice taster session, shall we say, and that's just what we need, because we've got very little or no motorsport going on internationally in the coming weeks and probably months. So hopefully this will give people something of an idea of what they're going to be looking at for their racing fix in the weeks to come.
I really hope that if people watch this race, and we know that people did, because at one point we had more than 50,000 people tuning in, that's crazy. How many racing series outside Formula One can boast those numbers, do you think? Like that's a proper audience. So those that did tune in, I really think they must have seen something there that's going to make them want to at least be open to checking it out in the future. And not a lot of racing series in real life have that. It's hard to make people to make people go back. And the brilliant thing about esports is not only is it more accessible from a competition participation point of view, but there is an audience for it. We've seen that here. Okay, it's the only game in town now because of what's happened in Melbourne, but it's still legitimate and it's still a genuine option for people. And what I think is particularly encouraging as well is people can go check out the race on YouTube or at We Are the Race on social media. Have a look back through at the different things that we've shared from this event, the different onboards, the results, the names that were involved. It's really worth checking out. And I know there's a chance I might be preaching to the converted on this podcast, but I know that there are still skeptics about esports. So if you have a doubt and you're listening to this, do go check it out, because I really do think it was proper. And if you know someone who was maybe a bit skeptical, encourage them to have a little watch, because Max Verstappen, for example, he's involved in more of the so much sim racing. Him and the likes of Lando Norris, Lando took part in the Not the Oz GP event that Veloce Esports put on in which ran a couple of hours after the race and R Factor 2's event. These are people who are doing the sport of motor racing a proper service with something like this, and it deserves all the support it can get.
I think if you want a reflection of kind of how serious and how good this is, the fact that someone like Max Verstappen, who today should have been fighting for victory in the Australian Grand Prix, probably would have been on the podium if we'd had a Grand Prix here in Melbourne. The fact that he takes his time to do this at home, this is how he gets his racing fits. You know, this is a guy who races a real Formula One car, is a world championship caliber driver. And the fact that he not only is willing to do this, but regularly does this sort of thing, I think straight away you have to kind of take it seriously. Some people are not going to take to esport racing, and that's fine. You don't have to. But I do think there's an element of sort of derision to it, as if it's kind of not proper. But if Max Verstappen, a real proper driver, can actually get a lot out of competing in this kind of thing, I think that says we have to take it seriously. And this is the one thing, you know, the rest of us are never going to race a Red Bull Formula One car, are we? But we can have exactly the same experience that Max Verstappen has, give or take, given the kit. I imagine the setup he'll have access to is perhaps a little bit beyond the average. But this is the equivalent of just getting his Red Bull Formula One car and having the same experience as him. And so that's why it's quite nice, because as well as these high-level sim races, we can also do it at home. So we talk about the barriers to entry to motorsport, etc. But this is actually something where, you know, we can all have a go at it. We can all have our own sort of amateur racing online against friends or people at a similar level or whatever, and that's what I quite like. It kind of brings everything together and makes it just a little bit more connected.
Well, you know how I feel about online racing stuff. I've got a it's not a particularly fancy setup back home, but I've got a steering wheel, seat, and pedal setup. I like to play on on Forza and the official F1 game, because I've got an Xbox rather than the PlayStation, so I haven't dabbled in Gran Turismo. I don't have a proper gaming computer, so I've not done iRacing or R-Factor or anything like that. But even when playing games like that and actually getting involved in the more serious competitions in those forms of sim racing, I find that amazing. And I know that when we've had races, you've been a little bit sort of maybe found it a bit difficult to. I think you've found it fun, but maybe difficult to engage properly. But when we were watching that, you were getting properly excited and saying, "This is making me want to invest it in a proper setup." So, what do you reckon? Do you think you're going to be hopping online tomorrow morning and having a look and seeing what's available?
Yeah, I'd like to have a little bit of a go. I haven't done much of it that regularly. I did on Forza Motorsport some years ago. With some fellow racing journalists who used to play it a fair bit, and I quite like the fact that did kind of feel like real racing. I mean, I've done quite a bit of kind of club level amateur racing myself, and actually the kind of online racing, there are times when you do get into that sort of same zone you are in when you're actually racing a car, which I like. But it kind of whets the appetite. You sort of think, you know, I'm not going to be racing at this level, obviously, but because these are professionals who put huge amounts of effort. You know, these are not just people who are just dropping in. There will be huge focus on doing this. These are professionals doing it. But yeah, it gets me wanting to do it. And I think it's important at the point where that enthusiasm for motorsport, there's nothing to satiate it because of the situation in the wider world. So I think it's nice that there's something that people can watch and get involved with.
And it's something that it can inspire people to get even more involved, because you don't have to just watch it. It's the same as if you watch Formula One in real life as a kid. When you're watching that inspires you, like you want to go karting, you want to be there one day. But you know, even as a kid or a teenager or whatever age, it might make you want to go and get involved in racing, but you know you're not just going to go out and suddenly drive an F1 car, but you're going to go and maybe do some arrive and drive karting, or maybe you can do some club racing or something like that, or go into junior single seaters, whatever level you're at. And it's the same with esports. If someone has watched that today and gone, oh my word, that's really, really cool, I'd love to be able to do that, they're not going to suddenly go out and spend thousands of pounds on a computer system and steering wheel setup and a proper rig and stuff like that. But maybe you'll go, actually, do you know what? I know I can actually get a relatively affordable steering wheel and pedal setup and this for my games console, and it's going to cost me maybe 200 quid, and I'd like to get involved in it more, and I do like one or two sim races a month. That is a legitimate way to get into motorsport. It's much more cost effective than the alternative. I don't see why that's a problem. Motorsport is so expensive. Anything that reduces the barrier of entry is a victory in my book. And that's why I think something we could look back on something like today as a watershed moment for esports, because it got put in front of a big audience. There was one point during this evening where this event was the most popular stream online at the moment, bigger than much bigger genre of esport events, which says a lot about how many people were watching it. So I hope it gets taken seriously. I hope it has had an impact, and I hope that we can look back on it in whenever it is, a few months or a few years, and just say, when real world motorsport fell over for whatever reason, esports were there and were considered a viable alternative, and a lot of people found motorsport because of it.
Yeah, I think it'll certainly, when we look back, we'll be able to get a feel of the impact on it. It'll probably have drawn some more people into it, and you know, there's going to be further race events we're involved with as the race in the coming weeks and months as well. And straight away, I'm thinking, yeah, I'm quite interested in this, and I don't have to. You know, that's not. Just because I'm working for the race doesn't mean that it's mandatory to be involved in this. I didn't have to be up at 2:30 in the morning watching it and talking about it. That was just something I wanted to do, because I thought, great, there's some racing going on here. And yeah, I'm interested to see whether it's just a little flash in the pan, whether various people look at it and say that was quite nice and then never revisit it, or whether some get drawn in. I think it'll be the latter, because it's been able to hold people's attention clearly, And I think straight away, I'd like to think there'll be a few people who've watched that who'll start regularly visiting our esports coverage that we're doing on the race.com website.
Where as long as they don't forget the hyphen.
Exactly. Do not forget the hyphen. Well, I don't always say because I didn't say it just there, but I should have done. Thank you, Scott. But, you know, there's loads of this going on. And again, it's still something I'm sort of getting to know. But it's actually one of my favourite bits on the website because every time I look at it, it's kind of a world I'm not that engaged with, but you sort of every time I visit that subsection, there's some new things I'm learning about what's going on, and just starting to get a bit of recognition of the names. I'm a kind of rank amateur in terms of esport racing knowledge, but I find myself kind of wanting to know and understand more about it. And it's still obviously relatively early days and growing, but it's you know, it's a thing. And I think those who maybe attending to perhaps sort of shrug it off and dismiss it. Probably, I'd like to people just to have a look at it. And you may not like it. You don't have to, because it's not exactly the same. It's similar, but for some people, they won't click with it. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But don't automatically kind of deride it and write it off. You know, have a go and see what you think.
Yeah, and I do honestly think that the caliber of sim racer that was in this all-star battle, that is the sort of caliber of driver that one day there will be a driver who comes through esports and that's how they get into proper racing, and there will be an F1 driver who comes from esports rather than just an F1 driver who does esports, because as I said, the barrier of entry to motorsport is high. And if there are cheaper ways of doing it, but ways that still allow you to perform at a high level, as the very top level of sim racing does, because what people don't understand is that the sophistication of the systems involved here are extremely high, and they will only get better and better and better. And we know how ultra complicated modern F1 actually is now, and how much simulation plays a part in it. So it is not difficult at all to think that it is perfectly conceivable that esports becomes a legitimate platform into top-level motorsport in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, and already we've, in recent years, seen drivers coming into real racing. Obviously, Nissan were heavily involved in this. Drivers like Jan Mardenborough, there are many others who came through. Lucas Ordonez was probably the earliest one. You know, proper drivers who had serious careers. And we're seeing, you know, Rudy van Buren, for example, who's the world's fastest gamer. He's got a kind of foothold in kind of the real world motorsport. He's working with Mahindra Racing, isn't he, in Formula E. So,
and he was a McLaren sim driver as a result of winning WFG the first time.
Exactly. So we're seeing these kind of crossovers happening now. With the vast cost there is, even doing karting at a serious level is eye-watering sums of money, you know, huge sums of money required. And it's really fascinating because the technology is only going to get better, and the correlation, as it were, between how sim works and the real world is only going to improve. You know, it's not identical. I mean, for example, the thing I do find difficult in the gaming I've done is always operating the brake, feeling the brakes properly, because there's a few things you feel and sense differently to how you do in the real world, but they get closer and closer, and actually the better the setup you've got, the more realistic and the greater correlation that there is to that as well. So that's probably partly because I'm using very, very highly amateurish kits, shall we say. But there are similarities, and it's clear you're talking about transferable skills as well. All these drivers who are making that leap won't have succeeded.
And going back to the point you made about Verstappen and the fact that he invests his time in this, you know, he has a lot of options about what he can do with his life, with everything that he's achieved and the position he's put himself in, and he chooses to do this because this Max doesn't suffer fools, does he? He's not going to mess around on something just to. It's not just about fun. He wants to challenge himself, and that is the level of competition that this form of racing provides, and it will provide that for a lot more people again because it is much more accessible. And I'm glad that there's been an event like this at a time when people's attention isn't distracted by real world events and traditional forms of motorsport that would otherwise hog the limelight, because it's been able to be showcased to more people.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I'd urge everybody to have a look at it. It's on the race YouTube channel. You'll be able to look back at it. And like I say, there'll be further events coming up. So, you know, if you're a skeptic, have a look at it. See what you think. You know, you don't have to like it, but at least be open to it. I've really enjoyed watching these races. And these were very much just kind of taster races, really. They were short sprint races. The final was 12 laps. The qualifying session was 5 minutes, and the heat races were only 8 laps around the Nürburgring Grand Prix circuit. So it's you know, there's forms of this to suit everyone. Obviously, there was a Sebring 12 hours going on very recently, wasn't there? So there's all these sorts of different types of race, if you like, endurance racing, sprint racing, open wheel racing, GT racing, absolutely everything. It's I can't even pretend that I vaguely know how to navigate my way around this world, although I have been recently just starting to get a bit of a feel for it. It's a little bit like when you first kind of get into motorsport, and maybe you see Formula One on the television, and then you start to learn about all these other categories, which you might do when you're kind of first getting into it, maybe when you're much younger or whatever, and suddenly there's this whole world opening up in front of you. So yeah, do have a look at that. We've certainly enjoyed watching that here in Melbourne, and thank myself and Scott are very, very happy that we had actually some racing to watch. Well, that's it for the first part of the podcast. We'll be back after this for a little bit of real world Formula One chat with Mark Hughes joining us. Well, welcome back. For the second half of our podcast, we're joined by Mark Hughes as well as Scott Mitchell to talk about all things Formula One. The dust now, Mark, has settled on the Australian Grand Prix cancellation. We now know, which we didn't in the previous podcast for sure, that Bahrain and Vietnam have been cancelled, although we knew they were going to be anyway, but that's official. The suggestion is that Spain, or the implication rather, is that Spain and Zandvoort won't happen because they're talking about late May start or maybe Baku start. It's really, really difficult because the temptation is to try and rearrange a calendar, and we've sort of been trying to work out how it could be done. Mm. But the situation's so fluid, isn't it? All bets are off in terms of when we're going to get racing again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Formula One loves to control its environment, and it's brilliant at doing so and manipulating its environment. But here we've got something which it just can't control. It's powerless to control. It's a virus that's determining the narrative of the story. So, we say let's look at June as a possible start of the season. Yeah, great. Let's hope that's possible. That's feasible to do. But if you look at the extrapolation of where the virus is going to be, I've read several articles that say it's going to be at its peak in June. So that may not be a feasible start either. So yeah, it's a moving target the whole time. Just like the Australian Grand Prix was in the whole situation is.
F1 really doesn't mix well when it's the bubble that it usually exists in has to engage with reality. It's pretty safe and it's pretty resilient when it can survive most things. But as we've seen with what's happened with coronavirus and the pandemic, a few weeks ago, a few people that would scoff if you'd said, you know, this has the potential to change the face of world sport. A lot of people just thought, oh, well, that's, you know, a bit of a stretch. Can see why events in China need to be cancelled, but we can contain it. People don't take it seriously or underestimate the potential of it. And now we've seen that this virus is it's just relentless, because that's how something like this works. And we're paying the price for it now, because I think the consequences now are even greater than what people expected. You're looking at a potential shutdown of months and months, and who knows when it actually ends.
That's the amazing thing. Global sport is basically shut down. Even national sports are stopping happening. And even the one motorsport event that did get going, Rally Mexico, that's been curtailed over the weekend as well. So, you know, all these things are being affected. And what Formula One does have to do is obviously be very respectful of this, because the bar shouldn't be what's the earliest point we can start racing. It needs to be what's the earliest responsible point. Yeah. The World Health Organization over the weekend stated that Europe's now the center of the pandemic. So we have to remember that anywhere, it's a European sport, Formula One, heavily UK-based, a big proportion of it.
Yeah.
And so wherever Formula One as a whole goes, if Europe's still in that situation, people aren't going to want it to go there. It'd been equivalent of, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, something coming from China to elsewhere. It's moved around. So it's Formula One's got to be responsible here, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I think the perception coming to Melbourne was that if there was a risk, it was the risk of getting a lot of people together, thousands of people together in a public event. The circumstances of how it played out in the Melbourne weekend highlighted that actually it's the other way around. It's Formula One itself could bring the infection rather than it being responsible for the bringing the people that would transfer the infection. Obviously, both mechanisms can be at play, but in terms of the perception of Formula One and the wisdom of hosting a race, it's changed a lot.
Well, we heard over the weekend, Ross Brawn, in an interview with Sky Sports F1 with Martin Brundle, talked about still being hopeful of maybe an 18-19 race season after the late start. He talked about the need to plough through the August break. He sort of, in a throwaway line, agreed that a doubleheader races with two Grand Prix on the same weekend is not out of the question, although he did quickly move off that topic. So best case scenario now is we do start either at Monaco at the end of May or Baku in June, or maybe even if Monaco could go back a week and then you go Monaco, Baku, Canada as an opening triple header. But, you know, the smart money isn't necessarily on that happening at the moment, is it? That's kind of, we've almost got this 2-month window that will continue to move forward and could start to chew into that phase of the season as well.
Yeah, I mean, as it's structured at the moment, we have a nice, convenient a few weeks in the summer that we're effectively just bringing forward, but it's only in our heads. That availability may not be there. It could move the whole thing. So as things stand, if you planned around starting in June, you could realistically reconfigure the calendar to have most of the races there, and in the second half of the year, most of the existing dates would stay the same, and you could still do it that way. But if the virus eats into June and beyond June, it starts to get extremely challenging.
If we work on the basis that it starts in June, as Mark said, I think there are so many ways that you could reconfigure it, but it isn't unrealistic to think you can have a pretty healthy season, and one that doesn't require you basically racing up until Christmas. And we've had a few people get in touch on Twitter and elsewhere on social media at We Are The Race. They've asked us, you know, do we think a super season is an option, you know, run a 2020-2021 kind of calendar. That obviously there are many sort of implications to that and reasons why it can't happen. One of them being we've got all singing, all dancing new regulations coming in 2021, and they'll want that to be quite a normal situation. We've had a bit of a crack, haven't we, trying to work out what we think the calendar might look like. I'm sure Ross Brawn probably isn't going to be commissioning us to do his work for him, but if he has a look at the race.com, he might have an idea or two, as long as he doesn't forget the hyphen.
Of course, you've always got to remember that in the URL. But it's tricky. I think the question about rolling over into 21, I'd be very surprised if they do that. It would seem to me that there comes a point where you get so far into the year that the worst case scenario is probably that 2020's off. We'd hope that by 2021, the global situation is completely under control. Although we can't take that as a given. But I guess the worst case scenario whereby we have a 2020 season would be you could have a condensed season. This is, I think, where a doubleheader would come into play, because there's no point in doing doubleheaders if the season does start in June or whatever, because you're not getting any extra money. It's not like you can hold the Chinese Grand Prix and get the fee if you hold it in Bahrain on a Saturday. That doesn't work like that. But the doubleheader could be a mechanism if you think, because there's this notional idea you need 8 races for a championship. Ross Brawn suggested he didn't think that was an issue. But I think setting aside what the rules would indicate about it, you do need probably a bit more than that to have a credible championship. You know, if Lewis Hamilton were, say, to win this championship, and this is the record-equaling 7th championship, you'd want it to be kind of 12, 14 races for it to feel credible. And you could fit that into, even if you're not starting till October, you could have a rapid-fire series of races. And this is the situation that F1 faces, that there's so many different plans they've got to try and have in place, and juggling all these balls, dealing with all the promoters, what races that could move. There's some races like Bahrain, I imagine, is relatively easy to reschedule. It's a government promoted race, so they will be accommodating and they can be flexible when they fit it in. Australia, they've said it's not completely impossible they'll run it, but how on earth do you get this race running? When are they going to be allowed to build up the park again into it? That seems highly unlikely. And then you've got all the other races in between in that scale. What other races might be willing to shift to accommodate it? Very, very complicated task for the team at F1.
Yeah, and you got events like Singapore, which, you know, the whole city has to operate around that event, and it's sort of cast in stone. So, yeah, there's very variable degrees of flexibility from venue to venue. But, I think it's unrealistic to expect that we're going to get every race back, even if we start in June.
Yeah, there's not a chance of that. What about, Scott, the kind of human toll? Because we talk about getting rid of the August break. You could plough through that potentially, which the teams would have to agree to, of course. Although in that same interview with Sky Sports F1, Ross Brawn said, well, we expect the teams will agree to that if they want to minimise the economic hardship there. And it's obviously more races means more revenue, and the team's income is partly a share of that revenue. But, you know, if you're asking your employees to go through triple headers, a couple of triple headers, just plough through doing race after race, even if you do two-day weekends, another thing that Ross Brawn raised, Formula One's got to strike a balance here between what's realistic and what's asking a bit too much, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things. The first is that obviously we had a triple header a couple of years ago and the teams were absolutely adamant that couldn't happen again. But the thing that's different is that position was taken in normal circumstances, and the teams do need more races. So I wonder if a triple header now is not so much acceptable, but it's inevitable. And I think the teams would just have to, you know, they won't like it, but they'll have to go along with it. And on the flip side of it, you've got this argument about the summer break eliminating that. And there's a few people who seem to be taking the position of, well, you know, we get a bit of time off now, so that's okay. The two aren't directly, you can't transpose one onto the other, because having time off now is not the same as a summer shutdown, because there is work that needs to be done. You know, we've talked in a video that will be available on the Races YouTube channel about the winners and losers, because some people have now got more time to fix problems. So there will be work underway. You can't just switch off. And the other element of that is, just because you get a break now doesn't help if the season starts in June and we have 18 or 19 races between June and middle of December. And you have a run of, what did we work it out? Was it like nine races in 12 weeks?
Nine races in 12 weeks.
But that's a possible scenario. I'm not saying that's what F1 has proposed, but just when we were looking at the permutations, like we sort of looked at that. Nine races in 12 weeks and no summer break. You're going to be absolutely flogging the poor people. We feel a toll when we go through a doubleheader or even a particularly long weekend, but we're far from the first people at the track and far from the last people to leave. I'm thinking in particular the hospitality people that work amongst teams, and the mechanics who, you know, the guys who are deconstructing the motorhomes late into the evening and that sort of thing. They work relentlessly, the guys and girls in Formula One, and there will be a painful human impact on this.
And you have to balance it up. You know, if you're chewing into the August break, people have family commitments, et cetera, that, you know, they will have to try and fit in. And, you know, again, it's the real world intruding on Formula One, isn't it? People who work in Formula One, they will just knuckle down and get everything done. But at the same time, there is a kind of duty of care, et cetera, towards the employees. And also, you don't want to, you know, flay your employees too much, because then they'll start to struggle. They might move on. So that there's a balance to be struck.
Another impact on the teams, which I'm probably better off if I throw this question to you two, which is why I've interrupted you a little bit there, Ed. We talk about the minimum number of races, hypothetically, you need, not necessarily for the championship to go ahead and be a championship, but just to have something credible. But from a team's point of view, we know that a lot of them, you know, the prize money that you get from Formula One, the slice of the pie that you get your hands on at the end of every season, is a fundamental part of their business model. So I'm not saying you guys don't have access to the spreadsheets, you don't know the numbers, but realistically, how many races are you looking at before this becomes a massive, massive financial hurdle for the teams to overcome? A team like Williams, for example, I'm not saying this to frighten anybody or anything like that, but just to put it into perspective, they're at the risk of losing a lot, aren't they?
It depends on the races, and I think that is something we have to factor in when it comes to rescheduling.
Yeah, which races pay how much?
Exactly, if you're F1, you're looking at, right, well, Monaco doesn't pay anything. Nice prestige race, but we can probably live without that for a year if we need to. But if you've got, there are other races that pay a lot more, and there's everything in between. So yeah. I'd be prioritising the biggest race, because just to put into context that question about the prize pot, the Formula One teams share a certain percentage of Formula One's revenue. So the size of the overall F1 revenue pie is directly connected to what they get from their prize money, which is based across the column 2 and the column 1 payments. So that's partly the past couple of years, partly what they've done in based on the latest championship, and then of course there's a few other
historic payments and things like that,
kind of thing. Yep. But yeah, so it's going to be, you want to put on your big ticket races, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And that's there's a balancing point to be reached there. So logistically, getting China back on would be challenging. But then again, China plays big money. Monaco would, you know, I don't know how easy that would be, but it's in Europe, but it's not paying any money. So yeah, there's obviously going to be lots of trade-offs to be made there. You would hope that we can get Zandvoort in somehow, because it's, you know, an exciting new event, massively popular, is it 3 times oversubscribed or something like that. Very, very popular venue. So you would hope that that's going to somehow, they'll find a space for that. But yeah, it's all theoretical at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. The coronavirus will do what it's going to do, won't it? And the world's going to have to react to it. But there are other implications as well. We talk about Monaco, it's not a paying race, but what does it mean for F1 sponsors, for team sponsors? And there's all these things, you know, the sponsorship deals that teams have will have been based upon doing 22 races. And, you know, if you do one or something, that's something. But what happens if it's a 12 race season? What clauses are there in contracts? What does it mean for drivers bringing money? So there's all these knock-on effects. It's going to have a big effect on the finances of the teams, whatever happens. That is going to happen. And you mentioned Williams, Scott. And the reason you picked Williams is we know they are, and in fact, they keep making much of this. They're kind of a pure commercial team, aren't they? They don't have a shareholder or two who can just fling endless money at them if they need to. They're dependent on their own commercial success. So it's a really complicated three-dimensional picture, and people be pushing and pulling at F1 to say, well, we want this. And every sponsor will have different races, because if you look at the top line, the global sponsor F1, they'll have different territories that are important for them. Some sponsors, they couldn't care less about certain territories. They're like, oh, I don't care about China. That's not, it's a big market, but we're not there. We don't mind. That's just a random bonus for us. Whereas for F1, it's important. So yeah, hugely complicated three-dimensional challenge, isn't it, Scott?
It is. Yeah. I do have a lot of sympathy for Formula One and all of the teams, because it's a situation that the bigger picture you can do very little about, apart from obviously these are all individuals in their own right, and like everybody, there is a responsibility to respond to this in a way that, you know, helps containment and fights against the spread of the disease. But beyond that, there is very little they can do. We've talked a lot about, in Australia, once the decision was made to go there, there were things that F1, for example, could do better. But that's specific to those events. Now we're not going to be on site. Now we're not going to be wrestling with a decision to, well, should Bahrain go ahead or not, or Vietnam. You know, that decision has been taken. It is the right decision. It just creates problems. But these problems exist in a much wider context that we don't have control over. And we were talking over the weekend here that there are other things as well. You know, the teams have got offshoots. There are Formula 2 and Formula 3 teams and other race teams around the world that exist on fine margins. And what are they going to do? Because an F1 team can just get down to business in the background and sort of see it, I suppose, as extended R&D time. But a team like Williams, do they have that option? What about an F2 team or something like that? So, yeah, so many layers to it. It's a painful situation. Everyone's got to try and knuckle down basically and deal with it as best they can. And sort of as Ross said, when it came to being willing to do a triple header or to make sacrifices for the better of the season, they are going to have to do that, and they are going to have to actually respond to the needs of the moment.
And when we look at the actual impact all this has had, well, it's amazing, isn't it? You know, Formula One's been threatened before, but it's never quite all fallen apart, isn't it? The oil crisis in 74, there was talk about that season not happening. Obviously, it all then did go ahead. You know, 55, after the Le Mans disaster, there was talk about all sorts of places banning motor racing, and that jeopardised the calendar, but muddled on. F1's always kind of led a charmed life and muddled through all these things without massive disruption. You know, you have to go back to the pre-World Championship days, I guess the Second World War.
Interrupted
Grand Prix racing, created a great controversy about who won the 39 European Championship, of course, as well.
Which we don't
often talk about on this.
No, we don't. It was Muller, wasn't it? But yeah.
It was Stuck was the other one, wasn't it?
Lang.
Oh, Lang, of course. Yeah, because there was some. Yeah, but it was Muller.
And I think we only realized who the champion was in hindsight when we actually saw the regulations and how they, so it was several years later that we learned who the 39 champion was. that's a cul-de-sac we didn't need to go down.
Well, we absolutely had to go down that cul-de-sac.
We're going to have enough time and enough content to feel that we could do an entire podcast on this.
Well, I'll dig the regulations.
Well, here we are. When was the first motor racing world championship? You'll know this.
The first motor racing world championship.
Well, the first world championship. First world championship of Grand Prix racing.
1925.
Exactly, yeah. Which is often forgotten. And then we had the European championship in the 30s, which was a big thing. And
the first world championship was only for the teams.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Are you
yeah.
proposing year by year reviews, like one podcast episode for every year of a Grand Prix world championship?
We could start with 25 and Alfa Romeo, okay. Yeah.
Or we could tell the story of the unknown driver.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, another time.
Yeah, we will do that because that's a really, really fun story.
Welcome to this special episode of the Race F1 podcast, which is a planning meeting, apparently, for future podcasts.
Oh, I tell you what, we're going to keep talking through this period and we've got a lot of cul-de-sacs we can head down. Don't you worry about that. Now, we were talking about something. What question did I ask you?
I don't know where you were going.
Oh, disruption. Yeah, this is disruption. Finally the world has caught up with F1, hasn't it?
Yeah, so... existential, you know, the last time motor racing's right to even exist was probably 94 with the Imola tragedies, and it responded as it had to just to show the world that it was, you know, addressing the perceived dangers. So I with this, it's because it's such a random event that F1 hasn't done anything particularly wrong. Can you question its right to exist? You can question its right to exist in the current environment, obviously, but when that's resolved, and hopefully it's sooner rather than later, then, you know, I think F1 can look at itself and say it did okay.
There was a quote from Mattia Binotto in the build-up to Melbourne where he said, with everything that's going on at the moment, basically they saw it as their duty to try and put on a show and put a smile on everybody's faces. Now, obviously, Ferrari's position changed when there was a confirmed case of coronavirus in the paddock, because that situation is so sensitive, and they immediately saw that as the most responsible thing to do was to drop it. But the underlying point he made pre-weekend is absolutely valid, because while there are always, motorsport will forever have to justify its existence in a world of where we're fighting against climate change and different people having different financial resources and restrictions. If a company lays off thousands of employees globally, can they justify a $175 million F1 program plus whatever else they're spending? So that will always happen. But I always find that, like, motorsport and F1 in particular exists for many reasons, but one of the brilliant consequences of it, it acts as a beacon for what we are capable of, you know, as people and, you know, as humanity, and from a sporting point of view as well, technologically and sporting, you can achieve some great things and see some amazing spectacles. So I do think there is a place, because if you don't have that, you know, then you lose sources of inspiration for different people, sources of joy for different people, employment for different people. So I don't think it is, as you said earlier, just a case of when is it responsible for this to resume, and then hopefully it can do that on an even keel.
Yeah, it's a natural desire from everyone to have an answer to that, and there is no correct answer to that at this stage. I do find it a little bit odd that we've got this bizarre situation whereby the Spanish and Dutch Grand Prix are sort of been indicated they're cancelled, but they're not cancelled. And they've both issued statements saying we're liaising with F1, because the F1 statement said end of May potentially starting. So it's that's a little bit
weird. I guess that's just based on the expected the rate of expansion of the virus. Exactly. and whether the restrictions on crowd gatherings are still in place which they're due to be. So that, I guess that's just based on that.
And the restrictions are just changing by the day, aren't they? It's a very fast moving situation. But yeah, with a bit of luck, we hope that the situation gets under control reasonably well and we can get a sort of decent season in. But that's obviously a secondary concern. But as I said, we will keep talking, we will keep writing, we will keep shooting videos for our YouTube channel at The Race. We've been chatting actually about some ideas to do, and there's always a load of things we wanted to do that there's never quite time to do with all the races. So actually there will be some interesting things. We'd much rather be talking about racing, but, you know, we've got some esports to talk about, as we were talking about earlier in this podcast. And obviously we'll still follow the news goings on in Formula One, but we'll also have a few other interesting topics we can delve into with various guests. So while we're not looking forward to a few months at least without racing, we are quite looking forward to bringing you some of the more unusual topics, including, of course, the unknown driver, which I'm definitely going to speak to you about, Mark, because that's a, okay. That's a cracking and not often told story. Well, do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. All sorts of material on there about contemporary F1, retro stuff, quizzes, videos, you know, more podcasts. We've launched a load of podcasts, actually. There's a Formula E podcast. There's a MotoGP podcast. There's a Gary Anderson F1 show podcast, all launched just in time for No Motorsport to happen. So we've timed it perfectly. But even so, they'll all keep going on through the this no racing period because, the world keeps going and there's still lots to get into. And do check out our YouTube channel as we'll be shooting various videos for there. And there'll be some retro material as well because there's always some great past stories to tell. So we're quite excited about this in a way.
You might say that even though the races are off, the race is still on, Ed.
Exactly. Well, the race is on still, despite the fact the race is off. So, yeah, stick with us and we'll hopefully keep you entertained over however long this hiatus is.